It's not always true of operas, but in the case of Mozart's The Marriage of Figaro, the overture does set the tone of the day of madness to come. With a libretto by Lorenzo da Ponte, Mozart's opera was based on a play by Beaumarchais, a play banned in Vienna for its licentiousness. What difficulties did The Marriage of Figaro have to overcome to become one of the 10 most frequently performed operas in the world? I'm Norman Gilliland.
And I'm Emily Auerbach. This is University of the Year.
How does Mozart identify the characters in the opera musically? What's enduring about the opera's sense of humor? And what values underlie it? Our guests are William Florescu, General Director of Milwaukee's Florentine Opera Company, and Daniel Belcher, who plays Figaro, in the performances to take place on May 10th and 12th at Eline Hall.
Welcome to University of the Year.
Thanks for having us.
Thank you very much.
I saw that this was the number 6th most performed opera, I think. What do you think makes The Marriage of Figaro so special?
I think that it, and this may sound like a lofty answer to it, but I really think it's the humanity of the piece. It is a comedy, but I think it's a comedy about foibles. And I was thinking about this the other day that I think anytime anyone sees it, in addition to it being fantastic music, I think it's possible for us to see all of ourselves in each one of the characters. There's a facet of human nature in every one of the characters, and Mozart draws it so beautifully. I think that's why it's endured. That's
so if it's a day of madness, we see ourselves all being full of madness?
Speaking for myself, yes, for sure.
Can you set the stage? Tell us something about the plot.
Well, this is the day of Figaro's wedding to his bride, Susanna. Figaro is the servant to the count. Susanna is the servant to his wife, the countess. This is based on the second play in the Beaumarchais trilogy. So before, Figaro has helped set up the relationship of the count and countess, Count Almaviva and Rosina. And what turns out to be a comedy turns now into, a couple years later, a slight rough patch for the count and countess. The count has decided to reenact the droit de seigneur, which meant that the lord of the manor could have the first night of any marriage of any servant in the household, anyone in the home.
First night with the bride.
Exactly, exactly. Right. So what starts to be a happy day as Figaro is alerted to this information from Susanna quickly spins out of control as Figaro tries to turn the tables on the count.
And Count Almaviva, noble and yet not very admirable character.
Exactly.
Well, he's really a politician because he does a very political thing. He had renounced the act and said that it was no longer in effect. But with his attraction towards Susanna, he decides that it might be
advisable to reinstate
it. So yes, he shows his duplicitous nature.
Do you have a sense? Even from that, I realize that from the play to da Ponte's libretto, there was a lot of adaptation in order to just get it past the censors in Vienna. But do you have a sense, even from what's left, of what might politically have been a little too touchy?
Well, I think for the first time, really, both on the operatic and the dramatic stage, the nobility were shown in a bad light. I mean, opera theretofore in theater usually were peons in praise of nobility, some earlier on shown as gods, later just shown as nobles who made everything right. And in this case, the heroes are Susanna and Figaro. And Figaro addresses the audience, breaks the fourth wall, and the nobility, particularly in the visage of the count, is the anti-hero. And so that has remained. Mozart took a lot of the specific political nature of it out, but showing the foibles of the nobility certainly remained. But the emperor was enough of a music lover, he overlooked that.
he did indicate, however, that he didn't want it to run too long.
He had some proviso
saying you cannot repeat these individual arias, otherwise the thing's going to go on all night.
Right, right. Not too many notes.
But it definitely comes across as a critique of the class structure.
Absolutely.
Oh, absolutely.
Now, with you playing Figaro, Daniel, how do you see this character? I mean, in order to inhabit that role, how do you kind of...
Well, it's a joy to be able to do The Marriage of Figaro in addition to doing The Barber of Seville, because you get to see really a progression of a character. And Rossini and Mozart's takes on the pieces are musically incredibly different. But at the heart of them, you have this wonderful, vibrant character who always knows how to get out of a situation. out of trouble and thinks incredibly quickly on his feet. One of the things I find so special about The Marriage of Figaro is that in a lot of ways the tables are turned. It's Susanna that outwits in many ways Figaro. And so in addition to being just as a meditation maybe on class, it's also the wit and wisdom of women and the folly of men. And even when Figaro addresses, as Bill was saying, the in the fourth act, in his monologue to the audience, it's about men, open your eyes to what women are doing. In all actuality, it's men that in this situation are causing all of the problems and the women that will soon outwit the men.
There's really kind of a Figaro franchise, isn't there? Because before the Mozart, you had this Paisiello opera. So the same
right.
basis.
Well, in Rossini actually called his opera The Useless Precaution mm-hmm. in deference to Paisiello, because the Paisiello Barbarossa was a huge hit and Rossini was afraid that it wouldn't be able to stand up to the comparison. So he actually gave it a subtitle that early on that's what it was called.
Yeah, he was this 24-year-old upstart.
Right. But obviously that's a clip. So the Paisiello piece is actually quite delightful and is done sometimes. But, you know, the character of Figaro, you know, it really comes from the Commedia dell'arte tradition, mm-hmm. which was then used again as Harlequin and Ariadne and things like that. That character is so central and so attractive in drama and opera because they just make things go. It's why those roles, particularly the Figaro roles, are so coveted by singing actors, of which Danny is a fantastic example. And it's been mm-hmm.
unusual to have a comic lead be a bass. You know, I mean, usually you think of the bass as being the bad guy.
Yeah.
You know, and the tenor is the good guy, and baritone maybe.
Well, I made the decision. Danny is actually a baritone. There's very few singers out there who have the range and colors to encompass both the Rossini Figaro, which is a high baritone, and the Mozart Figaro, which is a more of a bass baritone. But Danny is one of those rare singers that can do both. And also, if you read about the first Figaro in in Marriage of Figaro, he wasn't a ponderous bass. And I'm a fan, and perhaps because I sang the role and I was a baritone too, but I want him to have the same buoyancy that the Rossini has. And sometimes when you cast a real bass, there's a ponderousness to it that
inevitably
takes away some of the sparkle. Mm-hmm. And so Danny has the depth of voice to do the lower stuff, but he still at its core has that vibrancy. And I think that's what the role requires. So to your question, when you cast a bass, I think it makes it harder to make that come across. Whereas with a singer like Danny, that it's much easier to make that work.
We do think of Figaro above all as being nimble.
Exactly.
Yes.
Exactly.
Yeah. No, and I'm thrilled to do it because it is something with our ears today, we rarely get to hear a baritone. I first came to the role hearing the wonderful singer Hermann Pry sing the role.
Oh, yes.
And also hearing Thomas Allen sing arias in a recital in undergraduate. And so I kind of came to the role as a baritone and approached it. But I rarely have the opportunity to do it because it is often cast now as a bass. So for me, one is a character study, and two is just to sing this glorious music. It's wonderful to revisit.
Well, let's hear some of that glorious music. What's the first thing you'd recommend to get us into the opera?
Well, one of the hardest things was choosing excerpts because it's such a fantastic opera. But I started with something, not Figaro's music, which we'll get to, but I started with Cherubino because, again, it's one of the great character studies in opera, and it's a pants role. In other words, it's a mezzo singing the role of a boy. And interestingly, in the original Beaumarchais play, he intended to have a girl play the role as well, even though it was straight theater.
We have so much role swapping mm-hmm. in the plot anyway.
Right.
It's hard to keep track of what gender anybody is.
It's sort
is.
Of a Victoria, mm-hmm. Victoria thing because it's a girl playing a boy who dresses up as a girl,
right.
which is sort of funny. But his first act, Aria Non So Più, where he just explains that every woman he sees makes his heart go wild. And it's such a great example of Mozart painting character with the orchestration and also the sort of breathlessness of the music. It paints a 15-year-old pubescent boy in, I think, fantastic fashion. So it's a great example of that.
That was Fiorenza Cosotto as Cherubino in The Marriage of Figaro, the Mozart opera that the Florentine Opera Company of Milwaukee is going to be producing this weekend, May 10th and 12th at Eline Hall.
What an irony there is to have a woman dressed as a man but singing about men and women. There's so much, I guess, costuming and deception and disguise and people hiding, jumping out windows, hiding behind. You know, it seems to be a play filled with all kinds of trickery and hypocrisy.
Well, you know, on some levels, it's really a French farce, but a French farce with weightier matter included in it. That's what's, I think, fascinating about it. And you can – it's a little bit like some TV shows or films where you can – you know, like Shrek, where you – as a child, you can take it on a certain level. But as an adult, you take it on a whole other level. And I think Figaro allows for that as well, that you can delve into it as deeply as you want, or you can take it at a lighter level. And I think, again, that's some of the genius of it. But it definitely is a matter of – deception and, like you say, escapes out windows and things like
now,
that. Would
Mozart did something not unusual at all for composers to recycle even an entire aria from one opera to the next and that kind of thing. But Mozart does something fascinating with an aria in Marriage of Figaro, and that is he kind of puts it on display again in Don Giovanni. It's mm-hmm. one of the most famous arias. And in the play Amadeus, when right. Salieri cobbles together this little yeah. march to celebrate the arrival of Mozart, Mozart says, oh, that doesn't work very well, does it? And he turns it into this aria.
Right. Yeah. Just having seen it here in Madison, the funny line is, too, when that is played during the banquet, I can't remember if it's the Don or Leporello makes the sort of offhand remark, oh, yeah, I know that tune. Like, it's like it's been overused, which I, you know, was sort of Mozart digging at himself, which I thought was sort of brilliant. Yeah.
Yeah. Well, it's a recycling.
Right.
And well, let's hear the original. Can you tell us, set up that aria that we're talking
about? Absolutely. This is the aria Non più andrai, which is one of the great arias of the opera, and ends the first act. He is putting on a display for the Count in terms of telling Cherubino what it will be like to go to war. However, all the while knowing that Figaro himself has plans for Cherubino coming up very quickly, but he has to prove to Cherubino that it will be great to go to war. The sounds of the bullets whistling by, life in the mud, life in the snow, all those glories that we associate with war.
Non più andrai.
Giorno d'intorno girando, belle belle trovando il riposo, narcisetto a doncino d'amor. Belle belle trovando il riposo, narcisetto a doncino d'amor. Non più avrai questi bei pennacchini, quel cappello leggero e galante, e quella chioma, quell'aria brillante, e quel vermiglio donnesco color, quel vermiglio donnesco color. Non più avrai quei pennacchini, quel cappello, quella chioma, quell'aria brillante, e non più andrai farfallone amoroso, notte giorno d'intorno girando, belle belle trovando il riposo, narcisetto a doncino d'amor. Belle belle trovando il riposo, narcisetto a doncino d'amor. Ma perché ripo farmaco? Rambo stacchi stretto sacco, schioppo in spalla, spada al fianco, dritto, muso franco, un gran casco, un gran turbante, molto onor, poco contante, e poco contante. Ed invece delle fandango, una marcia per il campo, per montagne e per palloni, con le levi sul leoni, al concerto di tromboni, di bombarde e di cannoni, e le palle in tutti i tuoni, all'orecchio fa fischiar. Non ti avrai quei pennacchini, non ti avrai
quel cappello non ti avrai quella chioma non ti avrai quell'aria brillante non piangrai in farfallone amoroso notte e giorno d'interno girando nelle belle turbando il riposo narcisetto ad uncino d'amor delle belle turbando il riposo narcisetto ad uncino d'amor perfino alla vittoria alla gloria militar perfino alla vittoria alla gloria militar alla gloria militar alla gloria militar
That was baritone Giuseppe Taddei as Figaro with one of the most famous of all opera arias. And we were saying during that it's not the lyrics that carries this through the generations. It's purely the force of Mozart's tune because of the words are, you know, not central to the focus of this opera. But there's some wonderful irony going on, too, that right. You can play with. How glorious going to war will be, not...
Yeah, and exactly. if we come to hear you, Daniel, what are you doing with this aria that's different from the recording that we just heard?
Well, what you've heard will hopefully, I will do my best to deliver it vocally, but...
no worries there.
What we're trying to do with the take on it is that in many ways this celebrates war and the glories of war and seeing the amazing mountains you'll go over and the valleys, but yet... In all honesty, a war is not glorious. There's a lot of trudging through the mud. There's no money, some days without food, and for many soldiers, coming back not alive. So we're trying to really add that element of fear, of apprehension, of reality, which is very interesting since we're performing Acts 1 and 2 together and then Acts 3 and 4 together with the intermission between 2 and 3. We decided that launching into the Countess's aria at the beginning of Act 2 with a level of seriousness, a level of edge, would really set her up beautifully. And I think it's a rather extraordinary idea, one that I had initially not thought of, but I credit Candace Evans, our wonderful director, with that.
We're going to look further behind the scenes at a production of Mozart's Marriage of Figaro when we return in a moment. This is University of the Air. I'm Norman Gilliland, back with Emily Auerbach and our guest, William Florescu, the general director of Milwaukee's Florentine Opera Company, and Daniel Belcher, who sings the part of Figaro in the company's upcoming performances of Mozart's opera, The Marriage of Figaro. You know, it's easy to talk about Mozart's genius and how we were just saying he was, at the very, very least, this great tune writer, but in terms of stacking up against other opera composers, what does Mozart do here that we don't find elsewhere?
Well, I think Mozart was a great man of the theater. He was very careful about working with Da Ponte in terms of the text and the way he would layer ensembles. We're going to get into soon the Act 2 finale, which for me is perfect in structure and music. It starts as a duet. Susanna comes in. It's added as a trio, then into a quartet, a quintet, and finally the three final antagonists make it into the full finale. But it's literally one wrench at a time tossed into the mix so that the chaos,
doesn't build or doesn't immediately appear. It's slowly built as it spins out of control. And I think it's very purposeful that he did it that way. It's structured very purposefully to mirror chaos.
Does the instrumentation go along with that too? I mean, in the way he uses different orchestral instruments?
Well, it's like moto perpetuo. I mean, the perpetual motion of the orchestra and how he just keeps it going is – it's really phenomenal. You know, there's very few composers, particularly when it comes to opera, that if you put a music theorist, a musicologist, a singer, a director, and a conductor in a room and you lay out different composers, you're going to find one that's going to appeal to this group of people. Mm-hmm. I think Mozart is the one composer in the realm of opera where the theorist, the musicologist, the conductor, the director, the singers would all – be in agreement about the genius of that person. Whereas if you had Verdi or Donizetti, you'd have some naysayers. But I think Mozart is the one composer of opera where every itch is scratched. great instrumental writing, great plot development, great text setting, wonderful music for the voice. He does all of that in a way that I don't think is equaled by any other composer. It's pretty phenomenal.
And what's the content of this aria that we're going to hear with these voices entering?
Well, first, I thought it'd be great to hear a little bit of the Countess and her entrance, because Rosina in the Barber of Seville is this bubbly girl that's full of life that has conquered everything. And only 3 years later in the plays, she's a bit beaten down by what life's dealt her, that the Count, who she thought was this Romeo, has turned out to be a bit of a...
Lecher?
For better words.
And so this aria, Porgy Amor, just really describes the sadness that she feels. And it's Mozart in his more languorous mode. It's really touching.
So this is from the opening of Act Two?
Opening of Act Two.
And that this is her entrance.
Yeah.
This is the place she begins.
He's brilliant. He doesn't bring her in at all in the first act. And this is the first we see her. And it really makes the character just pop, because this is such a totally different woman than what she was before.
It definitely does not sound like a comedy.
Not at that point.
No.
And yet I think all but one of the arias in this opera is in the major key.
I guess you're right. I actually hadn't thought about that. But
I had neither.
That's interesting.
And then when we get to Don Giovanni, just what is a couple of years later, it's all in the minor key, of course. Let me ask you a question, Daniel, a sort of an actor's question. What are you doing backstage when you're waiting to go on? I mean, what's happening back there?
Trying to remember my lines. No, hopefully that all that preparation's been taken care of. It's just readying myself for the next scene. My job as a singing actor is to be the storyteller. So for me, though, as an actor, I like to not think too far ahead, so that I am constantly listening and reacting within the moment.
Within the moment.
So,
when I'm standing, getting ready to come on stage, it's really all I think about is that first word that comes out of my mouth, which is my first idea as I enter the stage. And then let the information I receive from the other singers and from the music reflect then as the scene kind of spills out.
You were mentioning before that this act ends with a special finale where the voices gradually add, going
exactly.
from a duet to a trio to a quartet, and sort of all chaos but happening in a sort of gradual building fashion. How do we go from this gorgeous confessional-like aria at the beginning of Act Two to the chaos at the end of the act with the finale?
There's quite a journey even within there. There's the disguising of Cherubino. Figaro's plot to start turning the tables on the Count is revealed, and the Count comes in pretty much threatening the Countess, and that's how the Act Two finale begins. It's a rather audacious, strong pronouncement by the Count, and when he discovers that the words he has just said are not true, that's how it all starts to spill out of control.
It's fun, too, because basically he is right about the fact that Cherubino has been in the
Countess's
boudoir,
yes.
but they've been able to spirit him out the window. And so they think they've got that all covered. And then once that they think they've got him convinced that everything's okay, this drunk gardener comes in basically saying, hey, somebody like smash my flower pot and all of that. And and then the Count's going, well, maybe he escaped. And Figaro says, no, it was him. And how he puts that all together is really brilliant, as the Count and Figaro and the Countess and Susanna, and then joined by this gardener, have this interchange. It's really quite stunning.
Here they come.
Guardi il giardino, mille cose ogni dì gettar peggio, e poc'anzi può darsi di peggio, vide un uomo, signor mio, gittar giù, al balcone, vedete i garofani, in giardino,
sì.
Cosa sento?
Stai ci succede,
quel brigato,
Well, you said, Bill, Mozart was a composer, an opera composer with a strong sense of the theater. And bringing together all these disparate elements to demonstrate in a single aria, if not the whole opera, this night of madness.
Absolutely. It's unfailingly brilliant. I could listen to this opera every day, and right now I am. But whenever, I mean, it is always at the top of my list of pieces that just speak to me. It's phenomenal.
Can you say something about the visual element? Because, I mean, obviously we're doing radio and we're just listening to the sound of it, but if we come to see it, how important would you say the scenery, the costumes, what are you doing visually that sort of adds to the music?
Well, we're doing a traditional production. I have nothing against updates. We do those all the time, but I don't think this needs it. What I wanted in this show, I wanted a set and costumes that would show off what I think is one of the very best casts that I've been able to assemble since I've been at the Florentine, and let them do what they do. You know, sometimes the best rule of thumb producing a show is to just do the show. Mm-hmm. And if you have the guns to do it, that's what you do. And in this case, that's what we're doing. And I think that, and I use the personal pronoun, I shouldn't. It's we. It's all us doing it. And this cast is brilliant. So it's going to be a traditional production. It's going to look like a Beaumarchais French farce, which is what it is. And I think that it'll highlight the wonderful singing actors we have doing it.
It's a gorgeous set full of symmetry, which in one way it corners everybody in, but at the same time it also frees the structure and lets the structure break down. The last set with the gazebo and the garden is absolutely stunning. I think people will love the physical production as much as the vocal and theatrical production.
Plenty of furniture to hide behind.
Plenty of furniture.
And windows to jump out of.
Lots of windows to jump out of, yes.
That's right.
And your costume?
Stunning. Very, very period in nature. Very fitted and very Spanish. But a lot of fun to play in. Gorgeous. Absolutely gorgeous.
The character of Figaro. So how deep is he?
How deep is he? I think he has simple wishes in life. He is truly, madly, deeply in love with this woman. Incredibly protective of her. I think he feels he is smarter than he probably really is. And I think that's one of the beauties of this play, of this opera, is that he discovers, wow, Susanna is just as quick, if not quicker, than I am, which I think only feeds into his love of her more. He's a strong man. He will fight for what's right, and he has no problem standing up to the count. But at the same time, as a servant, he knows his place. So it's this wonderful clash of worlds and of times where the servant-master relationship is becoming more daring, more on an equal footing. And also the same with the male-female relationship, the perception that the man is always in charge when in reality it's usually the woman turning the wheels. And
well,
I think
former,
we can all still relate.
In the former case, you have to think a little bit about Mozart's relationship as a servant to, say, the Archbishop Colorado, sure, and how unpleasant that was, literally getting kicked out of his position. And the relationship between servant and master in Marriage of Figaro, and even in Don Giovanni, where Leporello, mm-hmm, right, doesn't go to hell. It's the noble Don Giovanni who ends up getting dragged down.
It's definitely, there is some of Mozart in, I think there's a lot of Mozart in Figaro, and I think there's a lot of De Ponte in The Count, because De Ponte,
yes,
was a bit of a
yes,
dissolute fellow.
Yes,
But no, I think you're absolutely right. I think there's some definitely autobiographical material in this show, for sure.
And with Act Two, the last thing that we'll hear before an intermission, what is the audience left wanting to know? What are the loose ends that bring them back?
Well, Mozart takes you on this journey where you think loose ends are going to be tied up, and then they just get exploded. So you actually end up with more loose ends than you thought you had, because we don't know how Cherubino is going to get out of the mess that he's in. The Count is trying to marry off Figaro to Marcellina, but that's been exploded. So how it's all, you leave the second act thinking, how is this show ever going to get resolved?
Dazed and confused.
Exactly.
And there's not much day left.
That's
well,
right.
We'll look more at the ending of the opera when we continue in a moment with the University of the Year. I'm Emily Auerbach, back with Norman Gilliland. Our guests are William Floresco and Daniel Belter, who are the general director and the Figaro for the upcoming performance of The Marriage of Figaro in Milwaukee, May 10th and 12th. As we head into Act Three, what would be the most memorable moment musically, would you say, in that act?
Well, for me, it's very short, a duet between Susanna and the Countess, where they're talking about writing a note to the ironically named Romeo, and basically they're setting up this plot where the Count's going to end up wooing what he thinks is Susanna, and it turns out to be his own wife, which then catches him in his hypocrisy. And it's, again, a little bit like we talked about Non Pien Drai, it being able to see it ironically. I think this duet is that way, too. You can take it as just a beautiful piece of music, which has become very well known to the general population, but there's also the sort of most subversive moment in the show where they set up the plot that nabs the Count.
Why is it subversive?
Because she's working against her husband with the aid of her chambermaid, which is, you know, the Count's always supposed to be right, and they're subverting that.
And we should add here that the Countess, whom you heard earlier, Elizabeth Schwarzkopf, and playing Susanna Anamofo in this duet.
Thank you.
Out of context, you wouldn't have a clue, would you, that this is from a comic opera?
Right.
but Mozart, even when he wrote his musical Joke, for example, which is a little fake symphony in several movements, the slow movement is pretty straight.
Right. Exactly.
I wish I knew Italian. I know you have the English subtitles up there yeah. and that one can read the libretto ahead of time, but it is a problem, isn't it, in terms of just, I mean, I'm sure that those of us who are not fluent in Italian just miss a lot of subtlety with the language.
Well, I will definitely say the titles help follow the twists and turns, but our job as singing actors is that we can tell the story through the power of the music, and that's our ultimate goal, and through utilizing the text. There's so many wonderful plays within the text, though, that De Ponte wrote. But having the titles there makes it very immediate for the audience.
The thing with Italian, more than any other language, too, is, you know, another function of language is purely its sonic
mm-hmm. right. yes,
thing on regardless. Your ear. And so it's just hearing the language just as a painting aspect of mm-hmm. what you're hearing orally. That was redundant, I know, but it's just, it's a beautiful language, even if you don't know exactly what's being said. And that's why when we talk about bel canto and why singers train a lot in Italian more than any other language, it's because it floats across the throat so beautifully. And it's, so sure. there's that aspect of it as well.
Well and that duet yeah. is so ethereal that you
right.
just mentioned.
Yeah. The yeah. only solution, gentlemen, is, of course, to see the opera the first time, reading the supertitles, and then go in. The second time.
That's right.
I love it. Absolutely.
And we encourage people to do that. Come twice.
So once we get to this rather sublime point in the opera, where does Mozart take us? It's, after all, got to have some kind of resolution.
Oh, there's still a long journey ahead. There is a lot of misinformation that comes between what we've just heard and the next aria that we'll hear in the fourth act, Susanna's beautiful Divieni non tardar. Basically, it's the comeuppance of the men. And when we get to this point, Susanna is singing in the garden, disguised as the countess. Figaro thinks she's singing this to the count, and the count, it's just, it's wonderful, beautiful madness. But in actuality, she's making a whole statement on the two men. One for the infidelity of the count, and two on the jealousy of Figaro. And so I think as we launch into this next excerpt, that's a wonderful place to begin.
And it's Mozart at his most simple. When Mozart is at his most simple, he's also at his most sublime. And one of the things about this aria where she's saying, come to me, don't delay, just most joyous love. Mozart's wind riding underneath voices is just so unbelievable. I sometimes listen to this aria and just tune the voice out to just hear what he does with the instrumental part of it. And how it goes together is just, I think, one of the most sublime moments in Western music.
Thank you.
This aria was beautiful as it is, has been the subject of some controversy.
Well, some years ago when Cecilia Bartoli was doing Susanna at the Met, she insisted on doing an alternate aria. And I'm losing the name of it off the top of my head, but it has the same recitative that leads into it. And the director, who I believe is Jonathan Miller, it caused a big stink, and he left the production because of it.
What's the problem here?
Well, having heard this aria, I'm a huge fan of hers, but I don't know how you leave this aria out of the opera.
Yeah, so why would she leave it out, do you suppose?
Because the other one is showier, and you know she's at her core a showpiece singer, I think.
So Mozart created several options for singers?
A lot of cases in Così he did it. The Count had an alternate aria. So that happened quite often. And that, you know, the sanctity of the score is a newer thing. People threw pieces from different operas and stuff like that. It was a much more willy-nilly process than sort of the sanctity we have for classical music scores today.
And so it's really a question of prioritizing either the storyline, keep it moving, or the moment and the showstopper.
Yeah, and also, you know, in opera has had its phases where the singers basically ran the show. Directors ran the show, conductors ran the show, producers ran the show. And this was in a lot of ways a singer's era. This also could have been a case, I don't know, where the local royal might have said, this singer, I want to hear him do this. And so you don't know who was running the ship in those cases. But, we've changed a lot in terms of how we view these things.
But are operas still often the subject of power struggles among performers, conductor versus singer?
Yes, I think that happens occasionally.
Clearly, as the situation you just mentioned, absolutely.
Yeah, I mean, that's at the Met in the last 15 years. So I think it happens less today. But, yeah, there's certainly still because, look, you can't do what we do, whether you're producing, singing, conducting, directing. You can't do it without an ego. And so I think as long as you can find a reasonable solution, I think there's nothing wrong with that.
Well, in a collaborative spirit. That you can assimilate all the ideas in the room, because everybody between the cast and the presenter and the designers and the conductor, there are tons of ideas flowing in the room at once. The
and
goal then is to assimilate into a common goal. Exactly.
Everybody's exposing.
Coherent whole.
Exactly.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. So what, as we close this hour on The Marriage of Figaro, what can you tell us about the finale?
Possibly the most gorgeous moment in all of opera. I'm a little prejudiced, I know, but basically at the end of the show, after he's been exposed as a hypocrite and you don't know what's going to happen with the Countess, he sings this most beautiful line where he says, Contessa perdona, Countess, forgive me. And she responds very magnanimously, in kind. And then everybody comes in and you have this most gorgeous slow ensemble that just lasts for a minute. And then sort of the day of madness comes back with the sort of scherzo finale. But for everything to come to a halt like that, and then in one moment he's reprieved after being this sort of not very nice guy the whole opera. Now, personally, I believe he's going to go back the next day to being exactly who he is. But at this moment in time, he's absolutely sincere. And Mozart writes it so beautifully. It's really a very special moment in opera, I think.
The only word that comes to my mind is sublime. And it is. It's that time stands still, and there's a glimpse into maybe the potential of what we can be as people and as humans. But it's fleeting. And I agree completely, Bill, that I have a feeling the next day out, the next pretty lady that walks by will catch his eye. But for this one moment, the potential of humanity is really quite extraordinary. And the potential for forgiveness, and that you can celebrate that. But Mozart doesn't let us dwell on it long. He wraps it up very quickly and wonderfully.
Oh.
Sublime but upbeat at the same time.
Yeah,
there.
Absolutely.
Absolutely.
If anybody could pull off that combination, it would be Mozart at the end of The Marriage of Figaro. Well, thanks for sharing some insights into this upcoming production this weekend, May 10th and 12th, Eline Hall in Milwaukee. It's the Florentine Opera Company productions of The Marriage of Figaro. And our guests today have been General Director William Florescu and Figaro himself, Daniel Belcher. Thanks for joining us.
Absolutely. Thank you so much for having us. Really appreciate it.
I'm Norman Gilliland with Emily Auerbach. I hope you'll join us for the next hour of University of the Air.